Shavua Tov and Chodesh Tov. Tonight is Rosh Chodesh Adar Sheni, a time when we anticipate the celebration of Purim, which will take place precisely 2 weeks from tonight. As a matter of fact, our very last shiur is scheduled for next Motzei Shabbos before they move the clock, which is Zayin Adar, exactly a week before Purim. Tonight's topic is we have to first complete what we'll call last week's topic, and then we'll move on to a new topic, Blineta. The topic for the first part of the shiur is Yerusha, inheritance. I can see it's a very, very important topic. Oh, that's good. Very, very important topic. We spent a part of the shiur on it last week, and I'd like to continue. To summarize briefly from last week, the unfortunate reality is that the laws of inheritance, as they are found in the Torah, as we mentioned already last time, I believe strongly that the Torah system is just, is fair, is wise. After all, it comes from the Rabbono Shlom himself. Nonetheless, as we quoted last week from the Gesher Achayim, a sefer written in Yerushalayim, Ir HaKodesh, years back, an individual who wanted to follow the exact laws of the Torah. So what did he do? He gave a Bukhar a double share. He gave all the sons one share, and the daughters got zip, zero. What happened? I will quote again what happened. Hinchil sina v'tachris u'pirud b'mishpachto. He bequeathed hatred, competition, and dissension, division in his family. So the people said, lo kedai ayol ashir echush alahorish sina. It wasn't worth it to leave money, property, and to bequeath hatred. Why do I say Purim? Purim is a time when Yohanan said, Yesh ta'am mefuzer u'meforad. And then Bali Musa explained that Yohanan was saying there were so many divisions in Klal Yisrael, and therefore they don't deserve to be saved. And therefore we come together, Lech knows as Kol Yehudim, when Jews come together and stop fighting with each other, that's the time when we are saved in the miracle of Purim. And we have plenty of enemies today. Plenty of enemies who want to follow the Chalila v'chalila, what Haman started, Chachmon al-Itzlan. And the way that we have our only strategy to overcome that is to try to make more peace within our communities. And as they say, peace begins at home. The terrible fight that exists within families that the Gesher Chaim is describing here must be avoided. Must be avoided. And my personal view, therefore, is that in order to avoid these fights, it's imperative that every person, every parent, when the time comes to write a will, should divide the property equally between all of the children, notwithstanding their gender, notwithstanding the status of a bechor. I will tell you, since I like to speak personally, this is not, I think it's of such great import, when my mother, Aleha Shalom, passed away, and my father said he has to now rewrite his will. And he said, you know, I'm a b'chor. So, of course, I'm a b'chor. Everyone knows the Paskin Chumash, a b'chor. I said, Abba, I do not want any more than anybody else. Not one nickel more. Not a penny more. I've been around the block. I've seen fights in the family. Even the best of families, they're all palsy-walsy. There's a few dollars that's between them. All of a sudden, people lose their... It's crazy. People have lose their marble. They lose their sense of proportion. I don't want one nickel more. Nothing. It's a Paskin Chumash, he says. I said, yeah, it's a Paskin Chumash. I don't want it, and you're not required to give it to me. But how do we get against the laws of the Torah? Can't. So that's what we're going to discuss today, how an individual does it, which is a pure, perfectly halachically valid, and even recommended, and even found in the Shulchan Aruch, without going against even one iota of the Torah's laws. You'll say it goes against the spirit of the law, which we've spoken about many times. No, because the spirit of the law is peace. The ultimate spirit of the law is Rocher Adach Eno V'chol Nesiv Oseh HaShalom. Yes?
So, when the Torah was given, were people on a higher level that this wouldn't happen? Or,
No. As I mentioned last week, it was very simple when the Torah was given. When the Torah was given, life was simpler. People understood there's a certain kind of a family unit, and the different roles for men and for women. So therefore, the idea of primogeniture, which, as you know, lasted way past biblical times, if you learn history, I remember learning European history, primogeniture, the Bechor occupied such an important role. He in English law, I think, he inherited the whole estate, everything. at least at one stage, that's what I learned in high school. I'm not sure if it's still true, or it's probably not true anymore, but I'm not sure if what I learned in high school is true. Maybe the revisionist historians have said that you were learning wrong in high school. But in high school, I learned that primogeniture meant everything went to the firstborn. At least primogeniture, at least something more. So it was accepted in the world. That's how the world was. And the Torah says that's the way it is. And it was accepted. Women had different roles in those days. Women were not businesswomen. They were not career women. They were, by and large, women who were at home, who did the what Rav Moshe called the most important thing for a Jewish woman to do, which is to have children and take care of them. And therefore, they were satisfied. They had no money, because the money went to their brothers and husbands who were brothers of their sisters-in-law. It works that way. And this was an incentive for the men to take care of their wives and for the wives to be secure in the marriage. Unfortunately, today, as I mentioned in passing last time, the financial independence of the women are leading to a tremendous single scene, unprecedented. Unprecedented. It did not happen before because they couldn't survive, so they had to get married. So not that the Torah wants women to starve. The Torah wants women to get married. And the Torah wants women to have an incentive to get married, an incentive to raise the children. They shouldn't have to go to work. They want Baba Kamad Av Tetzvav. Women are not B'nai Maso Matan. It means they can't buy and sell. Of course they can. But it means that they had a different role. And therefore, at that point in time, so the woman's not going to say, oh, I insist on getting everything from my father. Because if she gets part of what her father leaves, so her husband's only going to get part of what his father left. So at the end of the day, I mean, it all shakes out. You know, it depends on who's richer, the father or the shmer. But you know, that's case by case. So it worked out. Yes, Eddie.
I don't want to pound this to death, but I think his question was very good. And your answer, you said we're not going against the spirit of what the Torah wanted. Well, let's take another law that we discussed, you know, like in our shiurim and here, which is that a man could divorce a woman, a woman can't divorce a man. And I just picked that. I'm sure there are better examples, but there are many examples like that. Maybe that was true then. And we're going to go in the spirit of the law that we want a family unit to be, you know, to be what it is.
Right.
We should change that maybe, or find a workaround, a better workaround for that.
Eddie, I'm not arguing with you, but we haven't found a way around it. I mean, there's someone who lives not far from me who says that when there's a rabbinical will, there's a halachic way. It's not true. It's just not true. It's not true. It's not true. It's not true. Sometimes there is and sometimes there isn't. It's terrible that there are some women who are chained and whatever the details. I've spoken about Aguna. We spoke about it in past shiurim. But I agree with you. I'm very sympathetic to helping any woman to get out of an Aguna situation. But we can't change the law. We are unable to just abrogate a Jewish marriage. We don't have the kelim. We don't have the ability. Here there's an ability to do, which I will describe in a number of. You have to remember, here fundamentally it's money. Money, there's a lot more leeway the rabbis have when it comes to money. For example, it's the need of Hefker, Bezdin Hefker, which we've spoken about indirectly in some of the shiurim. The rabbis have tremendous power when it comes to money. Marriage is not the same. Is that? You can't. Okay, but thank you for your question. In any event, here's the issue. The question is, before we go into my advice, what happens if a person leaves a will? Old-fashioned will, last will and testament, and he does nothing else but the will. We spoke last week about the fact that it's very likely that this will is halachically null and void. And the reason for this is that once a person dies, he's unable to transfer property to anybody else. Ein matono liachamisa. The Gemara tells us that. The question, what's the precise definition of a will? So, on a simple level, the will cannot work because it's given after death or upon death. However, it may work through the principle which we discussed at the end of the year last week called Mitzvah L'Kayim Divrei Hames. What does it mean? Mitzvah to Gemara. Mitzvah L'Kayim Divrei Hames. It's a mitzvah to fulfill the word of the deceased. And the question is, when does that apply and what are the exact contours of this halacha? Tosfos in Baba Basra Daf Kuf Mem Tes says that this only applies if the money was given to somebody else in the original person's lifetime. And they put it, hushlash mitchila lekach, was given to someone with the specific reason that when X dies, he gives it to Y to give to Z. In his lifetime, X gave it to Y, tells why you give it to Z upon my death. Then we say mitzvah l'kayim dibrei ha-meis. Where did Tosfos get this radical idea from? Never says that in the Gemara. Based on a certain question. What's the question? A question is a principle called divrei shchiv merakich suvim v'chim surim dami. Someone on a deathbed who makes a pronouncement even without official kinyan, it works. So the question is, who needs this? Just say mitzvah l'kayim dibrei ha-meis. So Tosfos answers, you know why? Because mitzvah l'kayim requires it was given to him, to a third party in his lifetime, and then he's on his deathbed. He has no, he can't do that right now. He has no access to his funds, his jewels, whatever he has. So therefore, they had introduce a new concept called divrei shchiv merakich suvim v'chim surim dami. That's Tosfos' answer. The Mordechai gives a different answer. The Mordechai says that mitzvah l'kayim dibrei ha-meis is only a mitzvah. It's a mitzvah. Notice the word mitzvah because it's a commandment. It's the right thing to do. And it's okay. It's fine to do it. But, if it's not a full kinyan, and if the heirs grabbed the money and sold it and put the money in a Swiss bank account, you can't do anything about it. It's not a formal, absolute kinyan. Okay. Shulchan Aruch quotes both. He quotes Tosfos' answer that you have to have hushtosh mitchilu lakachas and choshen mishpat simen reish nun beis. Siv Beitz. He also passes that same place that it's not a full kinyan. Obviously, you can't derive both conclusions from the same question, but La Halacha, he quoted both answers. The problem is that Tosfos wrestles with is the case that we spoke about at the end of the shiur last week about a shifcha. The case of a shifcha. What is a shifcha? Plonis shifchasi osli na koras ruach. Mitzvah l'kayim de riyameis. And the heirs should emancipate her after the father dies. The question, of course, becomes, was this shifcha given to a third party with this specific intent to give over to somebody else? No. So Tosfos answers, well, shifcha is different. For whatever reason. The Mordechai answers, he atzma shlisha. She herself, she is as if she's a third party. What does that mean? So the Mefarshim explain, is it de facto or de jure? Does it mean that you're giving it to another person, then you didn't give it? But maybe the idea of giving it to a third party is only to see to it that it can be done. In other words, over and against the will of the heirs. The heirs are entitled to ownership of this shifcha. She could probably run away. And since she can run away, then she has the ability to control her own destiny. Then even the halacha, she comes to Bezin, I'm not running away, but I'm going to go free because your father said I should go free. And they say, but no, but it wasn't given over to a third party. And the answer would be, it doesn't have to be. The third party is just an example of some situation in which it can be taken, since it's not in the hands of the heirs, therefore the same it's the kind of Rehameis. Why is this relevant? You write a secular will. Rav Moshe adopts the second position. That a secular will, even though the money was not given to anybody else, it's sitting in the bank account or in the vault or whatever you want, under the mattress, I don't know where it is, of the person who dies. But since a secular will was written, it's in the hands of the beneficiaries of the secular will, such as the daughters, for example, to go into secular court and to win in secular court, even they're not allowed to do that. But it's in their hands to do it. But since they can do it, this triggers mitzvah l'chaim d'vei ha-meis, and therefore they may do it. What a tremendous chiddush of Igros Moshe. So according to Rav Moshe's psak, all wills work, presumably, through the principle of mitzvah l'kayim divrei ha-meis. This is not only Rav Moshe, the Achiezer of Chaim Moses is something very, very similar. It's not, obviously, everyone agrees with this. Many disagree. Yes, ma'am.
Would a third party be considered the executor of the estate?
If the decedent, the person who died in his lifetime, gave the executor the cash, or maybe he gave him the stock deeds or the bonds, or I'm not sure, I don't know exactly what I have to give him, then we can argue. But if he didn't, which he usually doesn't give it to him,
the executor was just active afterwards.
Right. But so therefore, that's, I don't think it's going to work on that point.
What about Jack? You know, Ron asked me this at Charles Shudders. What about charities that are mentioned in people's wills?
Exactly.
And like they go and take the money.
Oh, you better believe it.
Okay. That could, if the Yorshim get it first, they don't have to give it to the charity.
That's correct. That's what would come out. But let's go further. I'm not finished yet. Don't leave till I finish. Okay. Now, the Shut Binyan Tzion, by the Oroch HaNer of Yaakov Ettinger in Chelik Bey Simon Chav Dalet, says that it's true that the Shulchan Aruch follows Tosfos. It's true. But that's only when the Yorshim are Mugzokim, when the heirs have the money. So then they're not going to give it up. They'll say, I follow Rabbeinu Tam. You don't apply mitzvah to the kind of Rabbis. Do you follow Rabbeinu Tam after Shabbat or Shabbos? That's a different story, Rabbi. Now I'm following Rabbeinu Tam. I'm holding on to this money. Okay. But if the money is not in their hands, it's in the hands of an apotropos, some kind of a trustee, then perhaps the din would be different. That's a very complex shiloh. I don't know if it's really true, because the apotropos is not holding on for himself. Why is he considered to be a muhzuk? The truth is that mitzvah kind of diri ames is a serious question in any event, because it doesn't work for something which is not yours on a simple level. So there are things which are accounts receivable, debts, who knows what, that are owed to the person who's about to die. Then according to most, the simple level, mitzvah l'kayim diri ames would not apply. So that difference is not going to be a full solution in any event, because at simple level, your bank account is account receivable. Your bank account means that the bank owes you the money. We brought this out last week a little bit. So they wouldn't work for that. Okay? More than that, what is the typical will say? We have some lawyers here. I bequeath, right? What it says? I bequeath? I think that's what it says. I hereby bequeath to blah, 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 blah. Does that work? Not necessarily. The Ramban says you have to say, I tell you to give to him. Then this is the kind of amazing. The only way we can justify it is to say, since it's an executor. Everyone has to have an executor, so it's as if I say to the executor, you fulfill what I wrote in my will. It's really a little bit of a grubber finger. It's not so simple. So for many reasons, mitzvah the kind of every amaze is certainly questionable. So now we come to my solution. It's not mine. It's a Ramah. Ramah is a very eminent authority. In Choshen Nishmet Simin Reish Pei Aleph Siv Zayin, talks about a shtar chatzi zocher. Let's review again, we mentioned this last week briefly. A shtar chatzi zocher meant that in the Ramah's day, in the 16th century, and it goes back already to the Maril, in the 15th century, maybe even a little before that, there was an enlightenment already. They were willing to give the daughters a half a share of a man. That's not politically correct, but certainly half a loaf is better than none. Before they were getting zero, they want to give the daughter half. So what do they do? A man has two sons and two daughters, and then there's no bechor. So instead of the sons getting 50-50, the sons will each get a third, and the daughters will each get 1/6. And this was done originally at the time of the daughter's marriage, in an irrevocable way. This is the way to increase the dowry, in effect. It wasn't a lifetime dowry, it was a dowry which would only be come into existence after the father died. But this the Edom, he's very happy to marry this girl, because he knows the father, the Shver, hot geld. And even the Shver wants to hold on to his geld, but the Shver won't live forever. And therefore, at the end of the day, there's a pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, namely 1/6 of the Shver Laban's estate. So the Laban who's been Swansik, but you know. So there this and that if it's done in an irrevocable fashion, it'll assist the daughter to get married. On this basis, the post can say it's okay. How come it fell into disuse? We don't have this anymore. So I'm mentioning once again the Marasham. It says the Marasham lived 100 years ago. I think his 100th Yahrzeit was just now, I read somewhere. The Gedur, the Berzhana Rov, from the greatest of all Rabbonim of Europe, of Galicia, lived a little over 100 years ago. He said, you know why it stopped? Because the daughters, in the Altaheim, the daughters were going to secular court and taking a full share. That's why it fell into disuse. So what's the point of giving them a half a share? That's what he says. So therefore, it seems to me that's a total disaster. And you lead if a father does that, he's allowing his daughter to be not only violating the law of going to secular court, but if she wins, the laws of theft apply. It's a disaster.
You didn't explain what it is. Exactly.
Patience. I'm coming to it. So therefore, the Gedolim of this generation, including my Rebbe, Rabbi Zalman Nachem Goldberg, have come to the concept that we should reintroduce the same idea. However, we can do it in the concept of Shtar Zohar Sholem. Let me write Chelik Zohar Sholem. Let me explain what that means. We have. Now I finally get to my sheets. I have one. I need a copy of the second sheet. I don't have myself. So if someone can just be altruistic. Oh, okay. Well, let me give you back the first one. Okay. Let's go. This is an article which was printed on Torah Web in 2007. The history is that Rabbi Shech the Shalita asked me to write this because he saw terrible fights in families over Yerusha. He said, you have to write something. Said, you know, this form itself, I had written 30 years ago at Rabbi Shechta's request. So now you got to say explicitly, I'd have to divide it, everyone an equal share, and go and write it. So Rabbi Shechta says, I jump. So I wrote it. So I'm not going to read the whole thing. It started with, obviously it was Parshas Noach. So I'll talk about Chum. Chum said to his brothers, Adam had two sons and one killed the other because of the inheritance of the world. That was the first fight of Yerusha. Can you imagine that? Okay. Now. So we can read. I think it's worth reading it because it's so important. Even though it seems to be a review, that's for the next day. If we get to it. Unfortunately, arguments within a family over inheritance continue to this day, from the beginning of time, from Adam Harishon. Right? Despite what the Torah says, there are families sometimes torn asunder by disputes, large and small, financially. Get heated and protracted emotionally. Does anyone disagree with this fact? Okay, so unfortunately this fact is clearly true. Sometimes, tragically, it's precisely a lack of appreciation of the Torah's laws which contribute to severe tensions in Orthodox families. The Torah provides laws, In the world of gender identity, this halakha can lead to resentment and worse by women who feel entitled to an equal share of the estate. Footnote 1 addresses Eddie's point. The reasons for the Torah's law are not completely clear, but we believe that the Torah is perfect and just. Perhaps the Torah provides incentives for the different gender roles by its laws, including inheritance. And I quote something else I wrote, which I explained in writing what I just told you earlier today. Good. The double portion allotted by the Torah to a firstborn can cause jealousy and worse, especially in the world in which primogeniture is an anachronism. The special status of the Bechor is the theme of many quarrels, including murder and attempted murder, throughout Sefer Bereishis. Kayin, Yishmael, Esav. Alright? Fine. In the interest of peace in the family, a surviving spouse should arrange that his or her assets be divided equally among the children. Footnote 2. Halakhically, a husband inherits his wife's assets. A wife is entitled only to support from her husband's estate until she remarries. Nowadays, it seems advisable that the wife should inherit her husband's assets. I told you this last week. This is from the Shalah. The Shalah said that parents should not give their money to children because it's a disaster if parents have to eat in the shulchan on the table of their children. And for that reason, it seems to me, in today's world, a husband should leave all of his money for his wife and vice versa.
You won't necessarily get that advice from tax. What? You won't necessarily get that advice from tax.
Again, everything I'm saying, as I mentioned in my preamble last week, I'm not a tax attorney. And there has to be a way, a creative way, for tax attorneys to allow what I want to happen without incurring the estate. They're very creative, the tax attorneys. They're much more creative than I am. They can move those laws around. I'm giving you my what I'm saying without reference to the tax laws. But I'm confident, again, and I spoke to some tax lawyers, that they can find ways to do these things with trusts and with all kinds of ways that seem to get around the tax laws. That's what the tax laws are doing, the estate laws are doing all day long. Okay. As I wrote here again, in the common case of joint ownership of a home or other assets, the surviving spouse is likely the sole owner according to halacha as well. That was last week's shir. Otherwise, a note of indebtedness to one's wife can achieve the same net result. What does that mean? A person, let me get to the cut to the chase. A person can say, I owe my wife, write a letter, I owe my wife 10... Depends what kind of community we're talking. 10 million, billion, whatever you need. We're a modest community. $10 million. Okay, sounds good. For most of us in this room. For most of us. $10 million, that's more than I own. So I owe her more than I own. So that if the person dies, then the wife collects everything as a creditor. Creditor. Simple as all that. Creditors, we all know, when someone dies, that's true in a second. No? Creditors come first. Before heirs. I mean, that's in every system of law, to my knowledge. So you've made your wife your major creditor. You owe her $10 million. Why? How? What? Where? Halacha does not require consideration. Halacha, I repeat, does not require consideration. Second law probably does. That's why this, that's very good for us. This indemnification is likely invalid in secular law.
What does consideration mean?
Very good. We have attorney, please tell us. He's a Harvard lawyer. Tell me what consideration is. What is it?
I charge for this.
What's consideration?
It's something of value that either a promise or an actual thing that you're giving in exchange.
An exchange. Yeah, you can't just say, I owe you. That's an exchange.
That's a gift.
Right. That's a gift. It's not... That's secular law.
I pay you something or give you something of value now in exchange for your promise. That's consideration. If I give you a promise that I will do something that's of value, that can be consideration.
In any event, it's very good that it shouldn't be effective in secular. It's good. It's better that way. Because in secular law, the will is effective. What I'm trying to do is see to it that the secular will, which is effective in secular law, should also be effective in halacha. And in halacha, there is no need for consideration. So he indemnifies himself to his wife for $10 million. The person dies, and now he left in the will all the money for his wife. She gets it in secular law because of the will, and she gets it in Jewish law because she's the first creditor. Gavaldik. Yes.
Because of secular law, then does she have to pay creditors with the money?
Whose creditors?
Well, his?
No matter what, those creditors are going to get the money. They're going to get it in the secular, they'll probably get it in halacha too, especially if they proceed this undertaking. Okay, fine. Fine. That's how it works. That's how it works. What about the woman to the man? Technically speaking, it shouldn't be necessary because the man inherits his wife both in inherits his wife in halacha, bal yorish es ishto. Who needs her note to him? It's still worth doing it. You know why? He doesn't inherit money which is not actually in her hand. A baal yorish es ishto only b'muchzok and aparoi. Accounts receivable, whatever, he doesn't inherit. That includes bank accounts. So whatever is in her bank account, he's not going to inherit according to halacha. Again, if they have a joint bank account or a jointly held home, as we spoke about the details last week, in all likelihood, in most cases, again, I'm not going to the details again, it's going to be survivability. Whoever survives gets it all. That, again, wouldn't need to bypass the laws of Yerusha. But there could be other assets, so it's worth it going...
If he gives her a note for $10 million, and she gives him a note for $10 million, and one of them dies,
mm-hmm.
even in Beis Din, don't those set off against each other?
No.
No.
I'll tell you why. So let's say, for example, the note that he gives her for $10 million, let's say, and he dies first. Okay? That's the case that we were primarily concerned about. He dies first. So she walks into Beis Din. He have a note for $10 million.
And the Yarshim say, yeah, but that's great. He has a note from her for $10 million, so that cancels that note. So
the question.
Now we're back to square zero, and we get all the thing, and she doesn't.
It's a good question. It's a good question. So the way out of that is, as we mentioned last week briefly, the note can come due a minute before death. So therefore, her note is right now totally irrelevant. But you're asking a good question. Okay, but the next, we have to think about it some more. Okay, fine, let's continue. Okay, fine. Now, one can identify himself to his daughters, a common practice 600 years ago in the Maril. A conditional obligation, shtar chatizocha, was used to grant the daughter a half a share. Let's explain how it's done. Again, I'm not going to read all this because it's just repeating what we said before. So how do you do this? So the way you do it, I will going to read you on the next page. I have in the next page exactly how it's done. Okay. A person who writes a will, this is on the page 2 of what we just gave out, should obligate himself to pay a sum of money greater than his total assets. It is stipulated that the obligation is retractable because these days you want to have it that way. It's not for the purpose of marriage. And it's not payable till 1 month before death. Therefore, the obligation has absolutely no effect during one's lifetime. So, if it's one person, such as a wife, more than you own. Okay. If the will includes many persons, the obligation is made to the prime beneficiary or several beneficiaries. In this case, it is further stipulated that if the Torah heir or heirs carry out the terms of the will and other government laws, then the obligation is null and void. Let's just go over it together again. A man wants the case I gave before, but just updated to the 21st century. The man wants his four children to inherit equally. Equally. Two boys, two girls. He writes in the will. I have four children, each one gets 25%. Sure. Good. In his, he accompanies that piece of paper, which goes into the hands of the lawyer, with another piece of paper, which is, I'll show you in a minute, which he writes, he obligates himself, identifies himself to his two daughters, to the sum of $10 million. 10 each, 5 each, I mean, depends what we're talking about. Okay? Now, the person dies. Daughters get all the money. Sons get nothing. But then it says, if the sons will carry out the will and give their sisters half for half the money, then his undertaking, his obligation is null and void. So these sons now have two choices. They play ball or they don't play ball. They get to follow the will or they don't follow the will. If they follow the will, what happens? They get 25% each. If they don't follow the will, what happens? They get zero. Because the sisters take all the money as creditors. What do you think they're going to do? Anyone say half a brain? So of course they're going to go along with the will. That's what a shtar chatzi zocher is. The obligation becomes effective when the form below is executed and delivered to the beneficiary or any other party, e.g. a rabbi or a Jewish attorney, should go to another Jewish person who receives it on the beneficiary's behalf, even without the beneficiary's knowledge. The person doesn't want, no one knows business what is in his will, what will, who, doesn't matter. You can give it, if your attorney is Jewish, or so you give it to a rabbi to hold on to, and it works. And it works. So I'm going to read with you together this sample form, and then we're going to complete our discussion. I, the undersigned, hereby obligate myself to the sum of effective immediately, but not payable until 1 minute before my death, on the condition that I do not retract this obligation in writing at any time prior to my death. If he doesn't, so there'll be a claim that he retracted. Nah, it has to be in writing. All the property which is mine at that time, both real and personal, should serve as security for the payment of the said obligation. Okay, so let's say, for example, husband wants to give all the money to his wife. He just, this paragraph, strikes the next one. But if he wants to give, he has two sons, two daughters, etc. What does he do then? I hereby stipulate that my heirs, as defined by the Torah, shall be given the option of paying the above obligation, millions and millions of dollars, or in lieu thereof, of carrying out the terms as specified in my last will and testament, and in addition, carrying out all transfer of property upon my death, which are considered non-testamentary transfers in accordance with the applicable laws. This has to do with trusts and other things, which you have to ask the lawyers about this. If my Torah heirs abide by the terms of my will and aforementioned state laws, then the above obligation is null and void. So the sons are going to go along with the will, because if not, they lose all the money, because the daughters got all its creditors. The above obligation is undertaken by a kinyan suda and a bezdin choshev, that same phrase we learned when we spoke about prenups, a proper means of transaction in important Jewish court. The above condition or conditions are made in accordance with the laws of the Torah, derived from Numbers chapter 32, Tanai b'nei Gad b'nei Reuven, signed this something, 20-something, and something, signature. This is it. It works. It worked. My father, Zichron Adoch, signed it, and it worked. And there was no problem. Everything went through fine. I'll tell you one more thing, and this is just how far I believe you have to go to avoid a fight. My father appointed my brother and myself as executors. I think it's by law. An executor gets $25,000. I don't think it's even a choice. Is that true?
Percentage?
Percentage? Really? Percentage?
Yeah.
Maybe no.
I'm not a state lawyer.
Uh-huh. Percentage. Yeah. What percent? I wonder how much I gave up. I think it was written in $25,000. I told my brother I'm not taking a penny. And I want to exaggerate what I gave up. Only gave out up 12.5 because I got went into the pot. I was afraid that my sisters. Who knows? I've seen people fight about a becher. They thought about pennies. I didn't want to take a penny. Yeah.
I think maybe the confusion is you can stipulate that you want the executive to have a
Okay.
But if it's not stipulated by law,
then it's a percentage. I don't know if I got more or less with this percentage, but it's irrelevant. I didn't want to take a penny. The money will, as we say in the Megillah, Revach Vatzola Yamel Ayhudim Yimokom Acher. This is, we don't want to make any fights. This is not mine. I mean, I wrote this from introduction to the end. I wrote this, I think, could be close to 30 years ago. Because I saw already this is a disaster, what's going on. And I gave it to people in the shul. Remember Stanley Rosenberg, because he was lived there? He helped me with it. He was an estate lawyer. Right? Yeah, sure, he's an estate lawyer. So he's the first one who helped me with this many, many years ago. And thankfully, this I picked it up on my own, but then I saw other good, you know, the Rabbanim picked it up in the interim. I'm going to give you a few sources. Rav Zalman Nechemya Goldberg is written in Tchumen, Volume 4, which goes back by now, probably 25 years ago, maybe a little more, 28 years ago, I think it was probably shortly after this. And then, more importantly for us in the United States, Rav Feivel Cohen, the famous author of Bari HaShulchan, one of the eminent poets of America, wrote an entire book on it, called Kuntres Midor L'Dor, all about this. Rabbi Cohen has something very similar to what I wrote. You obligate yourself, and you go into Bezen Choshev, the whole is almost exactly the same as I had written.
Rabbi, the obligation, yes, to the front of Bezdin Choshev, is that a legal document in secular court?
No.
Because otherwise the daughters, you might be opening a can of worms.
What's
the
which can?
Would challenge the validity of the other will, because they stand to gain under the first document.
The daughters, remember, the sons, according to this document, have the option of following the will, and assuming that the will is a valid will, properly executed, then if the sons follow the will, the obligation is null and void. So the daughter's going to say, I'm going to challenge the will now. Anything can happen. Michael's correct. Anything can happen in this crazy world. People challenge wills, and he wasn't of sane mind. That could happen anytime, without this piece of paper.
You can do another thing. You know, thinking about, let's say the guy gave half of his money to a charity, and then the other half he divided equally among his children, and the children decide they don't like that charity.
Right.
So the daughters will say, "We'll take the obligation," and now, you know,
the collusion.
Right, and then they'll pay. You know,
that's true. You're right. For that reason, Rabbi Feivel Cohen wants to give obligation to a third party. He's concerned about these cases. I'm not so concerned about these cases.
And the will is valid on the basis of mitzvah l'chaim divrei amen.
No. The will is not valid. It's strict halacha. The will is not valid at all. But the will creates a situation that the sons will not carry out the terms of the will. They'll lose all the money. So they'll carry out the terms of the will, even though the will is not valid. Okay. The will is not valid. Not valid. But the will exists. And the father indemnified himself to his daughters for $10 million. And now he dies. So now the two sons, they say to themselves, look, if they carry out the terms of the will, which is halakhically invalid, it's legally valid, halakhically invalid.
But halakhically, what's valid is a document giving everything to the daughters. Halakhically, the will is not
true,
valid.
But is it
convinced? Why don't the daughters take
read this paragraph. The paragraph I hereby is the critical paragraph. It's the next to the last paragraph on page 2. I hereby stipulate that my heirs shall be given the option of paying the above obligation, which means, you know, millions, or in lieu thereof, of carrying out the terms of special last will and testament, etc. And if they do this, then the above obligation is null and void. So it's in the hands of the sons to make this obligation null and void, which is what they're going to do. Okay? This is in effect the equivalent of the Shtar Chatzizach of the Rambo. In that case, you obligate yourself millions of dollars to your daughters, and if the sons will give the daughter a half a share, then the obligation is null and void. It's the same idea. It's just moved over to the last will and testament. Now, the question becomes... Yes, I'm sorry.
Under this obligation form...
Yes.
So if the husband signs over the obligation, all of his assets, to his wife.
Right.
So he leaves out the sons.
That's what, in my opinion, that's the right thing to do.
And then...
Because let the sons have to come on to the mother, not the mother have to come on to the sons. As we saw last week from the Shalom based on my Bava Mitzia. Yes.
Now, should at the same time the wife...
So there was a question before about offsetting obligations.
Yeah, in case you don't know who's going to go first.
Absolutely don't know. But the thing is, if there's a regular, ordinary will that the wife, let's say the husband and wife wrote a will that when he dies, it all goes to her, she dies, it all goes to him. So his part to her is not valid halachically. But her part to him is valid halachically, because by halacha, the husband inherits the wife. Only thing is, there may be certain properties that it won't work for. Bank accounts, etc., which are not in joint names. That's a question of, it's a good question, whether Ronnie's question is good enough to leave out that second piece of paper. I got to think about that. You asked a very good question. Yes?
What happens if the wife remarries?
Right. Good question. The wife can remarry, but even if she, there's a big question about that. It's an excellent question. The question is as follows. A man dies, and he wants to give his money to his wife, but he really wants to give the money at the end of the day, after his wife dies, to the children. It should be spoken about between the two parties. It should be written down, although I'm not sure how binding this is, that if either party remarries, and they should see to it that the money is going to go to their children and not to the new spouse. That can be done with prenuptial agreements and with trust. Similar trusts. So there are ways to do that. But that's a very good point. Yes?
What about if siblings have an unequal status? One has 10 kids and another doesn't have any kids. So
right.
One is rich and the other is poor.
So let me answer your question. It's an excellent question. I believe strongly, irrespective of the financial status of the children, and I say this with a measure of trepidation, nonetheless, no matter what, in my view, a parent should leave equal shares for the children. Because otherwise, it doesn't matter 100 reasons why he needs the money more, she needs the money less, it's a disaster. However, there's a big however. I do believe that's only in a will. As long as the parents are alive and children have needs, so parents are supposed to take care of their children as much as they need it to be taken care of, both in terms of money and in terms of time, and in terms of everything else. It's impossible for a parent to spend exactly the same amount of time with every child, and it's unreasonable to expect that the child, they should give exactly the same amount of money to each child, because they're taking care of, they have different needs. The unfortunate reality is that even there are terrible fights. I will tell you, I was saying a shiur on Thursday in the yeshiva, and somebody came into my shiur in the middle of the shiur, open in the middle of the shiur. Can you imagine that? I said, I have to talk to you. Okay, I'll talk to you after Shia. I said, so an hour we talked to him. Exactly, that's exactly. He has four kids, and one kid has more money. So he gave the kids, you know, what they need. He loves all his kids. And this one kid doesn't talk to the parents now because she feels deprived because the father paid for, I don't want to go into the details, he paid for Pesach for this one and not for that one. And silliness! And they're not talking to each other now. I want to cry. So parents who are helping out one child more than the other should not say a word. Just do it. Now, I know that there are children who keep score. Oh, daddy got this. I got a car for this one, and then only got this kind of car for this one, this kind of kid for this one. Oy, you know, it should be done with discretion. But I do agree with you that in lifetime, parents should take care of the parent's obligation. And people should have enough seichel, hopefully, to realize that a father and a mother have to take care of their own children, whatever which way, because he needs more and she needs less. It's all the other way around. Unfortunately, even that seichel is lacking in today's world. And I'm talking about in Rabbanisha families. I'm discussing, it pains me. But this happened on Thursday. 2 days ago, the story happened. So, you see how, okay? So your question is a very good question. It's interesting, in Machon Horoh, they have such a thing. And there they write that it should not go to secular court, and if it goes to secular court because they have tax implications, then it's null and void. It's written on the bottom of the document. I don't agree with that. In 1 second, why? The reason for that is the son will find a way to get it into the secular court. It'll become null and void. Keep all the money. So I would not write that, what Machon Horoh writes. But hopefully they won't get to secular court anyway. Yes, I'm sorry.
You were talking a lot about sons and daughters. But there's nothing here about sons and daughters in the thing you wrote up.
No, so you are correct, because I only gave it as an example. For in my introduction, I wrote, for example. Let's see what I'm talking over here. 1 second. So a wife. Correct. So maybe I should put it more specifically into the introduction. That when we're talking about many persons, right? I should give the example of a daughter. Right? It's a good point. Obviously, I mean a daughter, but I should put it in. Thank you. I'll try to note it when we... always. These things are always being redone. It's not the Aseret HaDibros. We try to always fix it up whenever we... A very, very valid point. Again, Rav Feivel Cohen, it says a married woman can't write a document because of the previous obligation we spoke about in this afternoon shir, that there's a certain... she owes things to her husband, which, and he's, that starts from the time of the wedding, so she can't write it anymore. I agree with him, and he has a whole complicated way out of it, 10 different stories, it's so complicated. But again, I think that the money should go to the husband in any event, and for this reason, I believe that we don't have to worry too much about it. Again, I'm concerned with the primary case, the cases of collusion, cases of women who don't want to have their husbands inherit them. I'm only discussing the simplest level. Yes.
Maybe you shouldn't put in the word daughter because it could be the person has two sons and he wants to avoid the problem of having to give them a daughter.
That's true. That's true. So maybe I should put that in too, you're saying. Okay, good. So maybe I'll figure out a way how to... Well, I mean, obviously, that's written, you know, in this whole lengthy of page one, it's clear. So everything you said, Ronnie, is clear on page one. So whoever reads this whole article, starting from page one, will see that I'm calling for giving to all children equally. Okay? Etc. Now, it's interesting, just to go to the top of page two, that the poskim say that a token portion of the estate, such as svarim, should be divided according to the Torah's laws. That's what the poskim say. In the old days, it said that svarim and real estate. Today, the house is the most single, most valuable asset.
It used to be.
Still. Michael, still. It's worth much less, but still the most valuable. And beyond that, in those days, the house had sentimental value because it went back 1,000 years in the family. Today, people live in the same house the next generation. It's a rarity. They sell the house. So that's that whole thing. Since the change in Torah's law is achieved through an indebtedness and not a bequest, it is permissible, just as one may transfer assets during his lifetime. The document below was drafted many years ago upon consultation with both Rabbonim and attorneys to make a will lawfully effective. While circumstances may vary, peace within a family should be parents' main concern during their own lifetimes and beyond. This is exactly such a critical point. So just to review, it seems to me that if a couple, if everything is in their joint names, everything of significance, the house, the bank accounts, in the joint names, so I'm leaving out the tax attorney. But from the perspective of halacha, there's no real need for anything because when one dies, everything else goes automatically to the other one. So the kids get nothing anyway because there's a house in the parents' name and the bank's in the parents' name and everything of significance in the parents' name. And the insurance usually, one's a beneficiary of the other. All right, I'm talking about the average person. I'm not talking about some multimillionaire. I think so.
Even so nowadays, there are lots of things that can't be in a joint name.
For example?
Retirement accounts.
But isn't the wife the prime beneficiary of the husband and the vice versa usually?
So if you do it that way.
I'm not looking to write these forms in a hurry. Okay, so if both spouses are alive, the parents of the children, and they're happily married, it seems to me there's no rush unless it's a significant asset that's not in joint names with survivability.
And then if a particular family has children all of one gender,
right,
it's less of an issue also.
It's less of an issue, yeah. In the case of, if they're all men, it's less of an issue, but it's a bit of an issue because of the Bechor. If they're all women, it's no issue because they'll get it automatically. Anyway, correct. Ah, okay, there you go. If one spouse passes away, it seems to me that the surviving spouse should fill out this form and give all the kids equally, and the parents can toss in their lifetime when they turn what age, 50, 60, 70, whatever. No one knows when his time comes. That they should talk this out. This is what they want to do. So when the one passes away, the second one should write a shtar, zochor shalom, as we spoke about, that everyone gets exactly the same amount in the last will and testament, and make a big, major obligation to the daughters if the sons will not fulfill the document. So there's not, I mean, hopefully no machlokes. This is what I'm suggesting. Okay, I feel very strong it should be done. And again, the tax, you have to go to your lawyer. This is my opinion. We're supposed to discuss a whole different topic tonight, which is the topic of positions of authority for women. That was on the official topic for tonight's shiur. And next week, our last shiur, we're supposed to talk about the future, the general future. So let me just give it very, very brief. I was going to give out these sheets. We'll give them out next week. I'll just have a very brief introduction, and Blineta next week we'll get into it, and we'll cram the future into the shiur as well. I was asked to talk about this topic last year when it was a very heated topic in this community. Because in this community, there was a formal appointment of an individual with the title of Rabbah. And the question is, what does Allah have to say about this title? And much ink was spilled, and worse, much rancor. We spoke before about not having rancor, right? That's why we spoke about the beginning. Much rancor surfaced as a result of this phenomenon. That's why I refuse to speak about it. Then, and I said, when everything calms down and everything is settled down, then I'm willing to talk about it. How long is it? It's a year since that happened. About a year? More? A little more. Okay. So now the year has passed. Everything's settled down. There have been many more scandals and tumults. And we had the Kabbalat Shabbat, which other issues came up in the community. But now we can talk about it in a dispassionate way. The Chazal teaches in the Sifri, Som Tosim Olecha Melech, Melech V'lo Malka. Says it. That means that the regent should be male, not female. That's how everyone understands it to me. The Rambam says it. Says so. The king. We believe in a male king. What we call a queen is simply the wife of the king. But she doesn't have any. And she may have all the power, but not officially.
but the word Jewish queen.
Right.
Wasn't there a Jewish queen?
Shlomo Tzion HaMalka. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. There was Shlomo Tzion. Now the Rambam extends this disqualification to all positions of authority, which leads to the problem of Devora. He shoftos Israel. Devora was certainly had a position of power. And I want to mention it up front that just as the Torah disqualifies a female, the pasuk goes on, Som v'sim alecha melech, the next words, Mikerev achecha. From amongst your brothers, not a non-Jew, and the rabbis teach us not even a ger, not even a convert. This caused all kinds of moral opprobrium. How could the rabbis say that a convert is not qualified to accept the position? Who has complaints against the Constitution of the United States of America, which says if you were not born in this country, and Obama is a besophic gadol, if you ask me, but anyway, other fakers have, but anyway. Is disqualified from being president. Is anyone tumult about it? Why not?
Arnold Schwarzenegger, maybe.
But he, with all of his muscles, he didn't get anywhere.
It's not politically correct, that's why.
Yeah, because that's okay.
It's in the Constitution.
That's it. It's not the Constitution. The Torah came before the Constitution. The Torah said so. That's all. Whatever the reason, the Torah, I'm sure, has reasons. The Kodesh Baruch Hu's reasons are we believe immutable and are just, and that's all. Fine. So the main question we have to discuss, and I want to discuss it tonight, but
I think it has a good practice. If anybody wants to know a practical reason, even if a president, why they did it for president, because if the country's in trouble and people are, you know, not feeling so happy about their leader, the first thing they'll say is, oh, he's not one of us, he's a gear, he's a good, fine.
But every other position about that, including Secretary of State,
right,
can be. Only
Henry Kissinger, he wasn't born in this country.
Can be a senator, you can be a
right,
cabinet minister,
okay, good.
Can the vice president.
Whatever it may be. Let's now go. So the question now becomes, we'll just take this on at the beginning of the year next week, Lynette. Next week is 8 o'clock as well. How do you define authority? Because the Rambam says, doesn't not only the king, any position of authority is included. And presumably, the source for the Rambam is not from a woman, but from a ger. Because the Gemara tells us that a ger cannot be the appointee who's in charge of weights and measures, or in charge of water distribution. These are executive positions, which are positions of authority. So what is a position of authority, and what is not a position of authority? This, of course, is the crux of the issue. The crux of the issue. How do you define authority? So, is a rabbi an authority? Is a shul president an authority? I'm just giving a few examples just for coming attractions. So, Blineta Next week on our final shiur, we'll discuss this very thorny issue. Hopefully in a dispassionate and calm fashion, we'll try to have shed light and avoid the heat. And in Mitzvah Shem, when we complete that, we'll have some final thoughts on this entire series. Thank you for coming. Good Vach and Chodesh Tov.